We are joined here in the KODX studios once again by Maria Tomchik, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right.
First, a little update on Jav.
Okay.
Jav's doing okay. He's healing well at home. Of course, he's in a neck brace, and it's going to take a little time, but he's hoping to be in the studio next week, he said.
That's his hope.
We'll see. There's no hurry. We want him to get a whole lot better before he starts traveling and giving us his take on news.
Yeah. But we will be taking pictures at some point and posting those online. Hopefully as a fundraiser.
Yeah.
And also today is December 7th. Guess what today is beyond being December 7th? It is Noam Chomsky's birthday.
Happy birthday, Noam.
Yeah. One of the people that got me motivated
me too.
Into being an activist way, way back when.
Yeah, got me motivated into being focusing on progressive media, I would have to say.
Yeah. So happy birthday, Noam, and many more.
Many more, we hope.
Many more. Still kicking. All right. So speaking of still kicking, the bike share program
is still kicking. The Seattle Department of Transportation released the third quarter bike share summary report on Tuesday. The Department of Transportation boasted that ridership is up and people are getting better at parking their bikes in places that don't block the sidewalk, crosswalks, and wheelchair ramps, which has turned out to be a very big issue for disabled folks and elderly folks who are trying to get around the city, finding bikes kind of littered in their paths in the past. Now, the second quarter report showed that 17% of bikes that were audited by SDOT were parked in a way that obstructed the sidewalk for people with disabilities. This new report showed only 5.3% of bikes were parked as obstruction hazards. However, there was a big problem with the report that they didn't point out, but that I found when I was looking at it. First of all, the city's target is for no more than 3% of bikes to be parked as obstruction hazards. In addition, there was a problem with how the city measured this statistic this time around. The third quarter report audited bicycles in a different set of neighborhoods than the second quarter report did. And the third quarter report looked at more bikes parked in downtown and in urban villages. That's commercial areas that tend to have wider sidewalks and therefore more space for bikes to be parked correctly. So when you have two different data sets from two different sources, you should really admit that those two data sets are not comparable. But that's not how the report is written and not how SDOT is talking about it. When I looked at the map of neighborhoods that were audited in the third quarter, only one neighborhood south of downtown was included, Pioneer Square and the Central International District. In the second quarter report, there were three Southeast Seattle neighborhoods, one Southwest Seattle neighborhood, and Pioneer Square, the Central District, were included. Now, the third quarter neighborhoods were heavily grouped in the downtown South Lake Union, Lower Queen Anne, and Ballard areas, with just two neighborhoods north of 65th Street and one south of Yesler, and that's the Pioneer Square Central District. So what that tells me is that the data sets are not only not comparable, they're very different, very, very different. Now, after the second quarter report was released and showed so many bikes parked as obstruction hazards, the city reduced the fleet size for both bike share companies by 1,000 bikes each as a penalty for not properly educating their riders. This new third quarter report shows a big improvement, so no further reductions are going to be made, even though the two data sets are not comparable. The city's which I think is possibly why they looked at the neighborhoods that they did in the third quarter is because they're trying to cut some slack to the bike share companies, and I find that to be objectionable myself. Now, the city is installing more bike parking, most of it on the street, and that's a good thing.
That's an improvement.
Yeah, that is an improvement. The city's goal for 2019 was to create 1,500 new parking spaces for bicycles. And each of those parking spaces could hold numerous bicycles. As of the end of the third quarter, the total that have been created is 1,250. So it looks like SDOT will easily meet the 1,500 space goal. So that is good news in the report. One startling statistic that's buried in the report is the number of bicycles that are deployed in the city that are malfunctioning and can't be rented. So, for example, if you want to rent a bicycle, but you can't, but then you can't because it won't unlock, or you can't get the bike to register on the app on your phone, that total was 51% in September from a random sample of 147 bikes.
That's a lot.
Yeah, that's more than half. That means that if you want to rent a bike, chances are pretty high that the first one you pick, just you won't be able to rent it. Won't work. The city's goal is for at least 70% of bikes on the street to be rentable. Of the two bike share companies in Seattle, Jump Bike is pretty close to that. Almost 65% of their bikes are rentable. So that means that Lime Bike is really struggling with only 36.6% of their bikes, just a little bit over one-third of them rentable at any one time, and about two-thirds of them just kind of useless trash laying around on, you know, sitting around on the sidewalk. So if you're in a hurry, I have to tell you, you should go for the red bikes, not the green ones.
Well, maybe they're lying on their side because somebody tried to fire one up and then it wouldn't, and then they threw it there.
That may be why a bicycle is laying on its
side. As a person that gets blocked by those things, I have many times thought about projecting.
Well, another problem with the report, too, is I walk to and from work in my neighborhood about 4 to 5 blocks to get to work every morning and home every night. And every day I move at least one bicycle on the way to work. Just in this, I live in the Lower Queen Anne neighborhood. And, you know, there are probably more people like me around town who are moving those, picking them up and just kind of shifting them on the sidewalk. You can't move them very far because they're heavy. And I can't remember which of the two bike shares you pick up the bicycle. If you move it too far, it starts talking to you. Put down the bike or I'll call 911, blah, blah, blah. And
that sounds kind of fun.
Yeah. And I always kind of respond, yeah, okay, go ahead, you know.
Yeah.
You know, but there are probably a lot more good Samaritans like me that are making sure bikes are parked properly. I just don't know that the bike share companies are working as hard as they should be in educating their riders. Now, in prior quarters, the report also shows that while coverage is good in central Seattle, including downtown, Capitol Hill, South Lake Union, East Lake, and the Lower Queen Anne area where I live, and the neighborhoods just north of the Ship Canal, including Ballard, Fremont, Wallingford, and the U District, they all have a lot of bicycles available for people to use. Coverage is a lot more spotty in North Seattle, which is north of Green Lake and 65th Street, and very, very spotty in parts of Southeast Seattle and in most of Southwest Seattle. As for the number of, and that's an equity issue right there, particularly for Southeast and Southwest Seattle, where a lot of lower income folks live, a lot of people of color live. They not only don't have access to protected bike lanes, they don't really have access to the bike shares either. And that's kind of disturbing. As for the number of trips, it was not a straight uphill trend. The number of trips on bike share bikes peaked in July with the warm weather. And by September, the number was back down to fewer trips than were taken in May. So bike share ridership appears to follow a seasonal pattern that corresponds with sunshine and with the tourist season. And given where the bikes are parked, I would say the tourist season is a high probability for why bike share soars in the summer. And weirdly, the map that was posted on the Seattle Department of Transportation's website also shows hotspots over water. I'm pretty sure that where bikes are parked, I'm pretty sure that that's a mistake, or else people are tossing their bicycles, these bike share bikes, off of ferries or the I-90 and 520 bridge.
Well, there was a photo of one of the bikes that was put on like one of the pillars for the 520 bridge, you know. So, and the mystery was how it got there.
Yeah.
Perhaps this helps solve part of that mystery.
Part of that mystery, yeah. The map has a cute little subtitle that reads, "This map shows all the places where people are riding!" Exclamation point. Well, they're not riding in the middle of Puget Sound or the middle of Lake Washington. That's either a mistake on the part of whoever formatted and posted the map, or that's bikes tossed into the water.
which could be your response if you pick up a bike to move it out of people's way and it says, put me down or I'm calling 911. It's
or
like,
you
okay.
Or you try to rent.
Put you down the water.
Or you try to rent a Lime bike and the first one you can't rent and the second one you can't rent and the third one you can't rent. I guess by that time you're probably ready to start throwing them over the side of the bridge.
Get a workout.
Yeah, anyway.
So any mechanisms for giving feedback to the city on perhaps learning how to do statistical analysis?
Contact your council member, particularly if your council member sits on the Sustainability and Transportation Committee. Of course, the current council members are going to the current council members and the current chair of that committee are headed out of office for the most part. But there are some that are sticking around: Lisa Herbold, Lorena Gonzalez, Teresa Mosqueda. You can contact them and or your new city council member once the new year starts.
Right. But again, it gets back to one of the issues at the city level is the city is continually chirping about data and how important data is.
Yes, they are.
And
they're having trouble getting the data, in a good, meaningful format that provides us with real information that reflects reality.
Maybe they're going to have to do some trainings and everybody sit together for a PowerPoint or two.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. And speaking of which, this week there was multiple meetings both at the county and city level regarding the Regional Homelessness Authority.
Yeah. The King County Regional Planning Council passed a lot of amendments to the plan that Mayor Durkin and King County Executive Dow Constantine released earlier this year for setting up the Regional Homelessness Authority. Now, the Regional Planning Council is made up of representatives from King County Council, a couple of representatives from the Seattle City Council, Deborah Juarez and Shama Sawant, and representatives from other cities in King County. So it's not just only the King County Council, and it's not just King County Council and Seattle City Council. In fact, Seattle City Council members are a distinct minority because there's only two of them on a much larger regional planning council. Now, a couple of those amendments that the Regional Planning Council came up with came under criticism by the Seattle City Council this week as Councilmember Sally Bagshaw tried to get the council to vote on the new plan. One of the changes involves the composition of the regional authority's governing board. It now contains mostly politicians, three from Seattle, that would be the mayor plus two city council members, three from King County, that's the King County exec plus two county council members, and three from the Sound Cities Association, which is the group that represents smaller municipalities in King County, as well as three members who have lived experience of homelessness. That's a full 12 members of that board. This irked council members Lisa Herbold and Lorena Gonzalez, who both pointed out that the funding for the agency will still mostly be coming from the city of Seattle to the tune of about 57% or more of the funding. If smaller cities now have more to say, why aren't they also contributing more money to the agency? That was the gist of their questions. In addition, the new plan would provide an avenue for what's something called regional sub-planning. In other words, those smaller cities can now draw up their own policies around homelessness, which might conflict with Seattle's, and the regional agency would have to honor those sub-plans and put money towards implementing them, money that comes mostly, again, from Seattle taxpayers. Another issue that came up in city council discussions is the fact that elected officials, in other words, politicians, will have ultimate control of the policies and budgeting for the regional homelessness agency. On the one hand, you might think that's good because politicians have been elected to office by voters and theoretically they answer to the voters. On the other hand, the homelessness problem often requires policies that are evidence-based and which are not necessarily popular to voters or obviously ones that voters would support. So removing political grandstanding may be much more effective than past efforts like All Home, which relied primarily on local politicians and not experts in homelessness and policies that can really help address homelessness, making decisions. And politicians have a tendency to make decisions based on what they think will play well in the next election to their voters.
What's going to get them reelected.
Versus experts who are more likely to make decisions based on evidence, what has worked best in the past, been tried in other places and worked well. And that's a real issue here. So, for example, if the new regional body rejects low-barrier shelters and housing-first strategies, those are two things that have worked well in other cities, but can you can see a lot of resistance from particularly from mainstream and more conservative politicians to housing people before they've gone through drug and alcohol treatment, which is what low-barrier shelters and housing-first policies do. That would be rejecting two of the most effective strategies for getting people off the street. And that takes us right back to where we were before. So the whole point, really, of the regional homelessness agency is to unify the approach to treating homelessness and to not support a balkanized system. But when you add in, make an amendment that adds in regional subplans, you're really getting about as balkanized as you can get back to where we started. Now, Sally Bagshaw, who's been chairing the city council's select committee on homelessness and housing affordability, and who is pushing really hard to get the council to pass the plan for the regional agency before she's, you know, leaves off, she and other current city council members leave office, she actually admitted that there are issues with this plan at the city council hearing. She seemed to agree that with that assessment, saying that she didn't view the new plan as quote unquote transformational, which is the whole point behind the regional setting up a regional agency. Now, a majority of King County Council members, Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin, and representatives of the Sound Cities Association support these new changes to the plan. It's really the city council that's putting the brakes on right now. The plan is going to have to pass the Seattle City Council before it can take effect. The council has only one more meeting scheduled before the end of this year in which to review that the plan, and that's next Thursday, December 12th. If city council members propose any amendments in that meeting, and they're highly likely to, then the plan won't be approved until next year, and perhaps not until as late as February or March. That's going to cause further delay in setting up the Regional Homelessness Authority, but on the other hand, it means that a new, more progressive city council will have a chance to take a deeper look at the plan and a chance to work on the issue and push for changes.
Do you have any idea who the three people that are representing people who actually have experience with homelessness are?
No, we don't know that yet. This is just drawing up the composition of the board, coming up with a plan for who's going to sit on that board. Those three people with lived experience of homelessness, we don't know who they're going to be yet. We just know that that's a requirement that is in the plan right now. And the idea behind having them on the board is, you know, let's get some people in here who know what homeless people are experiencing and can tell you, give you feedback and tell you day to day and minute to minute while you're sitting in a board meeting, who can tell you, yes, we think that'll work. No, we don't think that's going to work.
Well, do we know who's going to select those people?
Each of the three governmental
bodies be each selecting one? So city council, Mayor Durkin would select one.
I haven't actually read the details of the plan, and it's changing day to day. But that is one of the things that is at issue, is who gets to select the governing board members, how often are they replaced. The governing board members will select the operations, the implementation board, or the board that runs the day-to-day operations of the agency, and will have the power to fire the executive director of that implementation board. And of course, we'll be able to veto policy and budget changes. But in terms of who gets to sit on the governing board, who selects them, how often they're replaced, those are all things that are being discussed right now and are at issue. So it's not a final document. And the city council is going to have more changes to it.
Sure.
So if people are interested in it, I would suggest going to the city council website, looking at the agenda and the supporting documents behind Seattle City Council's Select Committee on Homelessness and Housing Affordability. And typically, they post supporting documents there, so it's fairly easy to go to the City Council to their committee page.
Right.
Their committee, you know, click on the to find more committee agendas. Click here, and then you can go in and you can see all the different committees listed there, and you can dig down and find the materials that are presented at each meeting. That's
and
a good
county
place to
council
go.
Is also wrestling with
county
this,
council
so
also has
another
this.
Venue people can go to and
or
have
you can
input
go to the regional planning council's website and perhaps find the materials there
right.
as well
but
and
just places
it.
Where people can voice their opinions and have some degree of input even if it's ignored input
yeah
which it often is
yeah well like I say you know, contact your city council member. Deborah Juarez got reelected. She sits on the Regional Planning Council. She's a good person to hear from you. Mm-hmm. She isn't always quite as bad as we portray her. Sometimes she does actually respond to comments that she receives from her constituents and from other folks outside of her district within the city of Seattle. So she's a good person to talk to. Shama Sawant also sits on the Regional Planning Council, and she is much more likely to listen to and respond to constituents' concerns.
All right. So it sounds like it will be something we'll be revisiting for quite a mm-hmm. while here. All right, let's move on then. There's a study out about pollution at SeaTac or near SeaTac?
Yeah, some researchers in the UW's Department of Environmental and Occupational Health Science Department and the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering have released a 2-year study of air pollution levels near SeaTac Airport. It's called the Move Up Study, and that's MOV-UP, which stands for Mobile Observations of Ultrafine Particles. They were trying to measure the particulate matter that's produced by jet engines versus the usual particulate matter produced by automobiles. While automobiles produce fine particulate matter of around 2.5 microns in diameter, jets produce ultra-fine particulate matter of less than 1 micron in diameter, too tiny to see or smell, but which can be inhaled in high quantities and can be inhaled deeply into your lungs and cross into your bloodstream and cause very negative health effects like heart disease, lung cancer, reproductive cancers in both men and women.
I think the 2.5s can pass the blood-brain barrier,
they
too.
They can, too, so but these ultra-fine particles probably in
will
much...
will beat them to it.
Yeah, in much greater quantities. Yeah. And there's growing evidence that these particles can contribute to Alzheimer's disease and cognitive issues as well. Now, the neighborhoods between the north and south flight paths into SeaTac airports have the highest quantities of ultrafine particulate matter. Those neighborhoods are Angle Lake and Des Moines to the south of the airport, Highline and Rainier Valley to the north, and most of the city of SeaTac, which surrounds the airport. Ultrafine particles are not covered under the nation's clean air laws. This study was the first of its kind to look at air pollution from airplanes instead of automobiles, so it's a groundbreaking study. The study was commissioned and funded by the Washington State Legislature with help from the Port of Seattle and several other cities and agencies in Western Washington. The next steps, of course, are to ask what health effects can be attributed to aircraft ultrafine particles, since they haven't been studied much at all, and what can be done to reduce them near airports. Certainly, changing to cleaner airplane fuels that are not carbon-based could have a big effect on the health of people who, not just people who work in the airline industry, but also people who live near airports and beneath the flight paths of jets that are taking off and landing.
And you have to wonder about then places like Boeing Field.
You know, yeah, or Payne Field to the north of us,
yeah,
that are situated near suburban neighborhoods, mm-hmm. where there are a lot of people living fairly close to the airport and are directly under the paths of jets that are coming down to land and that are going out on takeoff. That's when they produce the ultrafine particulate matter that lingers closer to the ground.
And I believe I saw recently that the SeaTac was getting fairly crowded. They were considering other...
Yes, they're considering building another airport.
and sharing those fine particles with
particulate even, matters with an even wider range of neighborhoods. So
not that you shouldn't be.
This is one of those things that experts really need to look at and try to solve before that happens. Yeah. But it's also something that nationwide we should be looking at around airports.
Yeah. So I'm assuming these studies have been done elsewhere.
No.
This is the first one that we
know of on particulate matter from jets. So that's why that's why I'm talking about it, because it's really is a groundbreaking study and something that should be looked at nationwide.
And why they haven't studied it prior to now? Because you know we've
This was the home of Boeing. You know.
Yeah.
So
I could see why they wouldn't do one here until now, but the rest of the country has some very large airports, larger than SeaTac, and
you would think they would have been
fascinated with this issue.
Well, there's the funding. Like I said, the Washington State Legislature commissioned this study and put taxpayer money towards funding it. And so that is very important when you get Democrats and progressives into your state legislature. They have the money and they have the power to fund these kinds of studies and to task the leading state university, in this case, the University of Washington, to actually do studies like this.
All right, moving on. Supreme Court weighing in on I-976.
Yeah, this week the Washington State Supreme Court refused to overturn a lower court, a King County Court ruling that barred Tim Eymann's $30 car tab initiative from taking effect this week. That means that the new law, passed narrowly by 53% of state voters in November, won't go into effect until the lawsuit against it has worked its way completely through the state's court system. And that could take months or years. Meanwhile, the state and municipalities in Washington State, like the city of Seattle, King County, and smaller transit agencies around the state, can continue to collect higher car tab fees as they have in the past. But some of those agencies are deciding not to spend that money just yet, because if they lose the lawsuit against I-976, those agencies would have to refund that money to taxpayers, any money that they collect in car tab fees from this week forward. If they spend it now, they could end up in a hole later on and with half-finished transportation projects that they can't complete. Nobody wants that. So that means that many residents around the state are going to see transit cuts this coming year, even while the higher taxes remain in place and their transit agencies are still continuing to collect those higher taxes. The City of Seattle Transportation Benefit District has enough reserve funds to cover expanded bus service through next spring and possibly later. The City Council just passed a budget that relies on collecting car tab fees and that continues to spend it on transportation projects. And you can argue whether that's responsible or not. But the cities of Tacoma and Everett have made a different decision. They're continuing to collect the car tab fees, but they are setting aside those funds into an escrow account, and they're not spending it on transportation projects. Instead, they're looking at what they can cut next year, and many small municipalities are doing the same thing. On the state level, we're likely to see an immediate suspension of funding for some state transportation projects, and this is something that the state legislature is going to have to tackle in the new session in January. The new legislative session that starts in January and runs for just about 60 days. They could move funds from somewhere else in the budget, in the state budget, into transportation, but I think they're going to take out their red pencils and really just decide what they can cut or delay in the current state transportation budget while they set aside funds that they're collecting in car tab fees in an escrow account, which they may eventually have to pay back to taxpayers. As for new taxes, the state legislature typically takes years to negotiate new transportation spending bills. Next year is an election year, so no one is expecting the state legislature to raise new transportation taxes there. The entire state House of Representatives is up for reelection and half of the state Senate. So that's the situation with I-976. Even though it's not going into effect yet, it is going into effect for many state residents.
Yeah, I saw at least one article this week, basically showing someone that had to, you know, pay a, didn't get the, you know, the reduced $30 tab fees, had to shell out several hundred dollars, and it was a real tearjerker seeing that they had to, you know, do that and that not getting the access to the $30
that tabs they
that
were
we
promised.
Had voted that they had voted on and
the magic that Tim Iman had promised them.
Yeah, that Santa did not arrive on the third as they had hoped. So
yeah, that's true.
All right. So
The worst of both worlds there. Worst of all worlds there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, it's our own fault for not fixing things back when we had a chance.
Yeah, and most folks would say it's past time we had a state income tax.
Yeah. Yeah. Get and revamp that, our tax system.
And
here
that
in Washington
the taxes
state.
Are more fair and more progressive. Because if we had the state income tax, we would have $30 car tab fees, and that wouldn't be the main source for transportation funding for the state, along with the gas tax. The gas tax might be lower as well, so would the sales tax, would have to be lower for a state income tax to pass. And those are all regressive taxes. They hit everybody just about equally, and that's not what you want to see when you have a lot of families that are struggling just to pay the bills month to month.
Yeah. Again, this week, you know, an article about the kids in the Tacoma School District that had, and I can't remember, one of the Seahawks who basically paid their lunch bills, you know, $27,000 in lunch fees, you know, in the richest, one of the richest regions in the U.S. It's just insane.
Yeah, and the free school
lunch
program.
I mean, it was a
really
nice thing for them to do, but the fact that, you know, you have to have local... you know, sports celebrities
step forward and do that for a short period of time when that's an ongoing issue for kids and it's going to be for those kids for years in going to school with out having had breakfast, not being able to pay for lunch and going home to not a whole lot in the refrigerator.
Yeah. So, because we've got more than enough rich people here in the region that if we structure things properly, they could be paying
well,
their fair
share. Well, it's true for the entire country. We have more than enough rich people to help out in changing the growing income inequality and the growing number of people who are going hungry.
Yes, our influence tends to be much more powerful locally than it does nationally.
Yes, that's true.
So, all right, moving on to national.
Yeah, impeachment news this week. On Monday, the New York Times reported that two longtime associates of Rudy Giuliani could face additional legal charges, Igor Fruman and Lev Parnas, both originally from the Soviet Union, back when it was the Soviet Union rather than Russia, were arrested in October and charged in the federal district court in Manhattan with making illegal campaign contributions to U.S. candidates in exchange for political influence that would benefit their own businesses and businesses owned by Ukrainian most of them corrupt Ukrainian government officials. Parnas and Fruman attempted to conceal the fact that their political contributions were from foreign sources, and that's illegal under the U.S. law for foreign sources to make contributions to U.S. political candidates. This is aside from the new information revealed by the impeachment inquiry that Parnas and Fruman assisted Rudy Giuliani in his shakedown of the Ukraine. That information could lead to additional charges in their cases. Both Parnas and Fruman, it appears, worked hard on behalf of former Ukrainian government officials to get Marie Yovanovitch removed as ambassador to the Ukraine. Neither Parnas nor Fruman have ever registered as a foreign lobbyist in the United States, and that is what would be required if they were truly working hard on that. Federal prosecutors are also still investigating whether Rudy Giuliani broke the same lobbying rules by soliciting business from the same Ukrainian government officials he was negotiating with on Trump's behalf.
Has he returned to the U.S. yet?
No, nope, not yet.
Has he been gone for the week?
He has spent the entire week in Budapest. He started out in Budapest meeting with Yuri Lutsenko, one of the former Ukrainian prosecutors who appeared to be unwilling to work on anti-corruption measures that the U.S. government had been pushing for. And then he went to Kiev in the Ukraine, to meet with the leading parliamentarian who's been pushing the conspiracy theory that the Ukraine hacked Democratic National Committee servers instead of Russia in 2016, a guy by the name of Andriy Berkach. He's went to a KGB school in Moscow in when he was younger. His father is
Berkach or Giuliani?
Berkach. Berkach. Okay. His father was KGB, and when he was in the KGB, he was head of Ukrainian intelligence for the KGB. So Berkach is widely viewed within Ukrainian political circles as being a Russian plant or a Russian stooge. So that's the guy that Giuliani met with this week in an effort to try to dig up as much dirt as he possibly could on the Bidens and to continue ahead, just moving full steam ahead on this whole shakedown of the Ukraine, even as the president is being impeached for the same process.
Well, he might be also looking into perhaps like buying a condo there. And checking out other nearby countries as to their extradition treaties.
Yeah. Now, also this week, on Tuesday, the House Intelligence Committee released the 300-page Trump-Ukraine impeachment inquiry report that nicely summed up the evidence that Donald Trump, quote, placed his own personal and political interests above the national interests of the United States. That report was meant to convey the evidence that was heard before the House Intelligence Committee over to the House Judiciary Committee for them to hold hearings and then draw up articles of impeachment. The report contains some new details about Rudy Giuliani's record of phone calls, calls made not just to Donald Trump, but to practically everyone in the White House, from Vice President Mike Pence to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Energy Secretary Rick Perry, Budget Director and Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, National Security Advisor John Bolton, several mid-level White House officials as well. Everyone was in the loop, as Gordon Sondland testified, and the call records really prove that. And included in that loop was Fox News host Sean Hannity. Giuliani even made phone calls to Republican Representative Devin Nunes, the lead Republican on the House Intelligence Committee, raising the issue, of course, of whether Nunes should have recused himself from the impeachment proceedings over the past month. Nunes also exchanged phone calls with Lev Parnas, one of the two associates who was arrested and is now being tried in the Manhattan federal court. Also listed in Giuliani's call records is a 25-minute call Giuliani made to Kash Patel, former aide to Devin Nunes, who currently sits on the National Security Council. Fiona Hill, in her testimony to the House Intelligence Committee, said that she believed Kash Patel was funneling information on the Ukraine to Donald Trump, serving as Giuliani's back channel, and she had Patel removed from internal distribution lists in the Security Council. Patel has denied that he's ever worked on issues related to the Ukraine, but Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, the top Ukraine expert on the Security Council, also testified that he thought Patel was feeding Donald Trump information that the Ukraine was responsible for hacking the 2016 presidential elections instead of Russia, and that Donald Trump was under the mistaken assumption that Patel was the leading expert on the Ukraine on the Security Council and not Vindman. Patel has no experience on Ukrainian issues, and he has said so himself. As Devin Nunes' aide, he wrote the memo that tried to discredit the work of FBI agents and Department of Justice personnel investigating Carter Page and Russia's interference in the 2016 presidential election, and he was a notable critic of the Steele dossier, even traveling to London to attempt to, but fail to, meet with Christopher Steele himself. Also among Giuliani's call logs was a number denoted with a dash one instead of a name. Giuliani exchanged several calls with that number on August 8th, which was the same week that he was pressing the new Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, to make a public announcement of investigations into Joe Biden and his son, Hunter Biden, and whether the Ukraine had interfered in the 2016 presidential elections. Democrats on the House Intelligence Committee believe that that dash one number is related to, if not the actual phone number for Donald Trump. In the meantime, Democrats have pointed out that Giuliani's phone logs show Donald Trump and top White House officials using non-encrypted communications to to discuss sensitive foreign policy issues. Highly ironic, given how much Trump castigated Hillary Clinton for using a personal email server when she served as Secretary of State. Also on Tuesday, a three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit in New York ruled that Deutsche Bank and Capital One must surrender documents related to Donald Trump's finances to the House Intelligence Committee and the House Financial Services Committee. Trump has 1 week in which to file an appeal before the banks are required to turn over the documents. He is very likely to appeal that to the Supreme Court. On Wednesday, the House Judiciary Committee held a hearing with three legal scholars called by the Democrats and one called by the Republicans. Although Democrats invited Donald Trump to send his own attorneys, Trump declined that offer and told them, in spite of all of the Republicans saying, why are you hurrying up this impeachment? It's going too fast. It's going too fast. In Donald Trump's letter declining sending any of his legal representatives to the House Judiciary Committee hearing, he said, hurry up, get this over with. So once again, Donald Trump and the Republicans in Congress are not on the same page. Now, the three legal scholars called by the Democrats each gave their own opinions, and they all seem to agree. In fact, they all did agree that Trump had abused his power as president for personal gain and had engaged in the very conduct that the founding fathers and mothers feared when they gave Congress the power of impeachment in the Constitution. Even the scholar called by the Republicans agreed that Donald Trump's behavior could be seen as grounds for impeachment. Where he parted ways with the other three legal scholars was on how the impeachment hearings have been conducted, saying that he thought it was all happening too fast and with too little evidence. He wanted to see more evidence. Of course, he should have gone back to talk to the Republicans and Donald Trump, because Donald Trump and the White House have been refusing to provide the evidence that firsthand evidence that the House Intelligence Committee and now the Judiciary Committee have requested. But this week also, 500 legal scholars have signed an open letter saying, quote, we, the undersigned legal scholars, have concluded that President Trump engaged in impeachable conduct, end quote. That's the opening sentence of their open letter. They also say in the document, quote, his conduct is precisely the type of threat to our democracy that the founders feared when they included the remedy of impeachment in the Constitution, end quote. The signers of this open letter include law professors from Harvard, Yale, Columbia, UC Berkeley, Stanford, the University of Washington, Rutgers, the University of Michigan, UCLA, George Washington University, Penn State, Georgetown, and many, many, many other law schools around the country. It's worth reading their open letter, which was published by the nonprofit Protect Democracy. And if you Google it, you can find it online. On Thursday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi officially asked House committee chairs to begin drafting articles of impeachment against Donald Trump. And by today, the Judiciary Committee had released their 55-page report that lays out grounds for impeachment. And I have not had a chance to read that report yet, but apparently the grounds that they are using for impeachment include abuse of power, betrayal of the nation through foreign entanglements, and corruption of office and elections. And that refers directly to getting the Ukraine to investigate Donald Trump's leading Democratic rival in the 2020 presidential campaign, Joe Biden, his son Hunter Biden, and Hunter Biden's company that he sat on the board of, Burisma. So that's the update here on the impeachment hearings and the impeachment process.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine Joe Biden being the leading opponent. I mean, yeah. Based on just what he continues to...
How he continues to perform in the Democratic debates,
yeah,
and
his No Malarkey tour and
The campaign trail.
Yeah. The videos just keep rolling out.
That's true. And it's interesting that Donald Trump is so narrowly focused on Joe Biden when there are there are many other candidates in the race that are have a good chance of being able to get the nomination. Not just Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, but Pete Buttigieg is getting a lot more coverage in the media. And I think that's because he's seen as the mainstream, almost conservative Democrat who can go head to head with Joe Biden in terms of they have similar policies and they present themselves in similar ways. You know, they're both white males. They're both very focused on national security. They both are supportive of the global capitalist system, unlike Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, who say, hey, look, you know, there needs capitalism will only work if you have checks and balances in place that keep it from its worst excesses. That's the Warren take. Sanders is an outright socialist, saying, you know, no, you can't let capitalism go unchecked. So those are the main candidates that he has to deal with. But he's always been focused very, very laser-like on Joe Biden as his main threat.
Well, and in some ways that's understandable given the way that the DNC seems to continue, and a lot of corporate media seems to keep presenting Joe Biden as such a, you know, solid front runner.
He's the solid choice, unless you think that we need another needless billionaire like Michael Bloomberg. The reason Bloomberg got into the race, I think, is because a lot of leading Republicans leading Democrats in the Democratic National Committee and a lot of big donors to the Democrats said, oh my God, Biden's not cognitively with it anymore. We need someone who can jump in here and counter Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. Somebody who can follow the kinds of policies that Hillary Clinton supported, the kinds of policies that her husband supported, things like repealing Glass-Steagall, for example, which happened under Bill Clinton. We forget that the banks got so as big as they've gotten because of a policy that was passed under the Bill Clinton administration, and doing things like putting limits on how many benefits people could get if they're in the welfare program, requiring people in welfare to work as well as receive benefits. And this week, one of the big news items was the Trump administration tightening rules that states could follow on work requirements for the food stamp program. That's something that all started back in the Clinton administration, with the Clinton administration and his staff putting forward and making sure that the Democrats and Republicans in Congress passed work requirements and limits on welfare.
Yeah. Clinton administration passed a lot of Republican-esque
policies and laws.
Restructuring that a Republican never would have been able to pass.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, I totally agree. And that's what people were looking at when they were looking at the race between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump in 2016. It's like, do you vote for bad or worse? Yeah. And some folks, unfortunately, didn't see Trump as worse. They thought, you know, we know the devil that Hillary Clinton is. We don't know whether Trump might be better, even though he's running as a Republican, because he had been a registered Democrat before then. And unfortunately, they made the wrong decision.
Yeah.
I think.
And just, again, looking at all the people he's brought in. It's all the people.
Yeah, exactly. Trump himself is not a knowledgeable person. And he's not a person who cares to learn new things or to learn all that he needs to know about the different topics that he makes decisions on. So he brings in these people to tell him what he ought to do. And sometimes he just does some pretty horrible things, as we've seen with his immigration policies. He has a far-right racist.
Stephen Miller.
Yeah, who is whispering in his ear about immigration, and he's following everything that Miller is asking him to do. And it has turned out really bad for the nation, particularly bad for the Trump administration, because they keep losing in court again and again and again on his immigration policies.
All right. Up next.
Let's talk a little bit about the UN emissions gap report.
Okay.
I think the two big things that people have been paying a lot of attention to in politics here in the United States are the impeachment process and issues with climate change, as well as issues with immigration. But I think climate change is really high up there in people's concerns right now. Now, a week ago on Tuesday, the United Nations released its latest report on the level of greenhouse gas emissions released by each nation in the world. The report said, quote, "The summary findings are bleak," end quote. For the most part, countries are failing to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions, especially the two biggest emitters, the United States and China. Greenhouse gas emissions have grown by 1.5% every year during this past decade, from 2010 to now. This means that deeper reductions will have to be made more swiftly to keep the world from experiencing the worst effects of climate change, including droughts, severe storms, swiftly rising sea levels, and famine. Emissions must now be cut by 7.6% every year over the next decade. I think previously the amount that they were looking at cutting, if we had started this process 15 years ago, was something like 3.5%. Now it's up to 7.6%. So it's doubled in the past decade.
And that's still probably conservative.
Yeah, that's still pretty conservative. Now, remember the Paris Climate Accords, the Paris Climate Accords reduction pledges were a first step. Countries were supposed to be revising those pledges and increasing their cuts over time. That has not happened. If every nation fulfills its original pledge under the Paris Climate Accord, average global temperatures would increase by 3.2 degrees Celsius, far above the 1.5 degrees Celsius ceiling that nations committed to in the Paris Accord, and that experts agree would help us avoid the worst effects of climate change. Now, if nothing at all were done, the temperature increase would be at least 4 degrees Celsius at this point. So the pledges that nations agreed to under the Paris Climate Accords and the small steps that they've taken have made some difference. Mm-hmm. But they need to take those bigger steps, and they need to first adhere to the goals that they originally pledged to, and then they need to take those additional steps. We've already seen global warming of 1.1 degrees Celsius. And we're already seeing the effects of climate change, from sunny day flooding in many coastal cities and towns to much more severe storms and wildfires here in the United States. And we just saw some very severe storms over the Thanksgiving holiday that affected just about every other part of the nation except for us here in the Pacific Northwest.
Oh, you look at Australia, it's been in flames for months now.
Yeah, yeah. Now, on Monday in Madrid, Spain, the nations that have signed on to the Paris Accord began meeting to finalize the details of that agreement, including the establishment of a worldwide carbon market and ways to help developing nations finance the conversion to zero emissions energy production, because there are many developing nations in the world who just don't have the money to do it, but they have to do it for the sake of everyone on the planet. Now, this summit that is going on right now is called the COP25 Global Climate Summit. And while the U.S. government is not expected to participate, there will be thousands of representatives from state and local governments here in the United States. There will be environmentalists, there will be activists, and there will be business representatives from the United States there to try and show the world that the majority of Americans do want to do something about our carbon emissions, even if our federal government is not doing anything. If anything, the Trump administration is withdrawing from the climate summit, is withdrawing from the Paris Accord in defiance of the scientific evidence that says that we need to commit to this. At the same time, there are activists who are pushing for even more change, who will be leading demonstrations in the next week and a half to 2 weeks while the climate summit is going on. And I would suggest, if you want to find out what they're doing to try to push for more change, you can read about those demonstrations and get involved. Extinction Rebellion is one of the groups that is working on pushing for more change.
Yeah.
So
plenty of things you can do locally.
There are lots of things you can do locally. 350 Seattle is a good organization. Extinction Rebellion is a good organization, and I don't think we have an enough of an active Extinction Rebellion chapter here in the city of Seattle, probably because there aren't enough people volunteering for that.
All right. So
let's go to events.
Yes.
Today, Saturday, December 7th, WTO protests 20th anniversary is going on with Joseph Stiglitz. That's an afternoon of workshops and an evening of speeches by Lori Wallach of Public Citizen and Nobel laureate Joseph Stiglitz discussing globalization and labor movements. That's hosted by the Washington Fair Trade Coalition. That starts today at 3:30 p.m. at Town Hall at 7th and Seneca.
That's when the workshops start.
That's when the workshops start.
Workshops go from 3:30 to 6.
Yeah, and then the speakers are in the early evening.
At 7:30.
Mm-hmm. Now, Monday, December 9th is Cesar Cuauhtemoc, forgive me if I mispronounce the name, Cuauhtemoc Garcia Hernandez, talking about his book Migrating to Prison, which examines the immigration prison system in the United States.
The subtitle is America's Obsession with Locking Up Immigrants.
Yes, that's at 7:30 p.m. at Town Hall at 7th and Seneca in the downstairs space. That's on Monday.
Also Monday, Council Member Shama Sawant has requested people's presence at City Council to encourage the city to do an emergency moratorium on winter evictions. That's happening Monday at 1:30 p.m.
Mm-hmm. So on Tuesday, December 10th, there's a film showing of a movie entitled Invasion about the Unist'ot'en camp and the Native struggle for sovereignty against the seizure of their lands for the construction of gas and oil pipelines. That's hosted by 350 Seattle and Mazaska Talks. That's from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at Washington Hall at 153 14th Avenue, about a block and a half north of Yesler in the Central District. On Wednesday,
I got something else on Tuesday.
Okay, good.
It actually happened before that. Tuesday at 11:45 in the morning, there will be a hearing at the Port of Seattle at their headquarters, which is located at 2711 Alaskan Way, Pier 69. And it's going to be regarding a vote by the Port of Seattle to allow or not Delta Airlines to begin using facial recognition at SeaTac Airport. This would be the first place in the country that would be using facial recognition. So again, this is like just as the report you
had earlier.
It's a groundbreaking thing. So if you have an opinion
not a good
on that.
Not a good groundbreaking thing.
No. So let the Port of Seattle know your thoughts on this. And again, that's Tuesday, 11:45 at Pier 69. And if for no other reason, you go there and check out the really swank a facility that your tax dollars have paid for at Port 69,
Pier
69 for the Port of Seattle. It's got to be one of the nicest facilities you will traverse.
Yeah, on Wednesday, December 11th is the open house at Real Change News. Come and meet the team behind the newspaper. That's from noon to 2 p.m. at their facility at 96 South Main Street at their offices for Real Change News. On Thursday, December 12th, you can testify on behalf of ORCA for All at the City Council's final Sustainability and Transportation Committee meeting of the year, where the committee will take public testimony, then discuss ways to expand free or low-cost transit service in Seattle. That's at 2 p.m. I think the public testimony comes first at 600 4th Avenue at James Street. That's the City Hall in the second floor City Council chambers.
Also on Wednesday at 9:30 a.m. at City Hall, City Council chambers, they're going to be having a discussion on the Seattle Clean Campaigns Act, and they'll have public and expert
hearings.
That's
Lorena Gonzalez's bill try to get PAC money out of elections in Seattle.
Or at least curb it a bit. Mm-hmm. So
that's
should
a good
be interesting.
One.
Yeah. So there you have it.
So there you have it. If you enjoy our show, if you feel it's a vital part of your week, we encourage you to go to our website at kodxseattle.org and consider becoming a sustaining supporter of KODX. There's a Patreon button at the top of our website. There's also, you can also click make a donation to KODX, and you can make a one-time donation to mm-hmm. the station. We also will take checks in any form, make them out to...
Well, preferably on paper.
Preferably on paper, yeah. Make them out to Earth on the Air Independent Media and mail them to...
To our P.O. Box, P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145. And the big news, as if what we gave before wasn't big news, tomorrow we've been working on it and promising it forever, but we've been slowly automating our broadcast. And tomorrow morning, I think we'll have the first...
So that we can broadcast more hours?
No, all hours.
All hours.
Not just more, all hours. In a
okay.
week.
Great.
So tomorrow morning we are, fingers crossed, planning on returning many of the Mind Over Matters programs that you used to catch over at KXP and before that KCMU.
And we're doing this because you don't actually live at the station, right, Mike?
I'm trying to get so I don't live at the station.
You have to have time to, you know, eat and sleep and do
shower.
Normal human things. So yeah. getting round the clock programming.
The church
involves...
where we're based has demanded that I leave.
And the only way to do that is to automate some of the programming. Right?
So basically, long story short, you should be able to continue to flip on your radio tomorrow morning or any time between now and then and be able to hear the broadcast. So I think
24/7.
Fingers crossed. So there you have it. And that's all due to the financial support that we've gotten from
listeners.
Many of our great listeners. So
yes,
they have made this possible.
Yes. And so we particularly need some donors who are in the bracket, in the tax bracket, where making donations really do benefit you tax wise. So if you're one of those folks who's in that tax bracket, please consider becoming a sustaining donor by going to our website, kodxseattle.org. Click on the Patreon button and become one of our regular contributors.
If your first name is Sugar,
and your
last name is
Mama or
Daddy.
Daddy.
Yeah, there you go. All right.